This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with David Rooney. His new book is The Big Hop. This is the story of the first flight across the North Atlantic from Newfoundland to Ireland, is the thinking, because that's the shortest connecting route. And they want to do this in a fashion to win £10,000, which in 1919 is a lot of money, a great deal of money, more than one person could spend in a lifetime. The man who will write the check is named Lord Northcliffe. Actually, his name is Harmsworth. And he's a self-made, multiple millionaire. Today, he'd be a billionaire. He puts up the prize again, and these men gather to take up the charge. They're the magnificent young men and their flying machines. We've met Alcock and Brown. Now, my favorite, a man by the name of Hawker, who's going to fly with Grebe. What do we need to know about Hawker, David?
Harry Hawker was Australian. He grew up in the outskirts of Melbourne. Like Jack Alcock, he became obsessed with motoring, motor cars, motorbikes, and ran he had a nice little life as a teenager, but he had an epiphany in 1910 when he saw Australia's first ever aeroplane flights, made perhaps quite remarkably by the famous escapologist Harry Houdini over dry grassland, Diggers Rest near Melbourne.
When I read that in your book, David, I thought, surely this isn't the Houdini. And it is. It is the who knew he had this sidebar of barnstorming. Did you know that beforehand, David?
I didn't. And throughout the process of 3 years of writing the book, it was just one moment after another of me going, "What, really?
Yes.
What, that guy?" Harry Houdini decided to have a side hustle, and he decided to buy an aeroplane in Europe, teach himself to fly it, and then fly it over Australia to be Australia's first birdman.
Oh, so, okay, Harry Hawker's watching, and he now, how does he get from what you'd have to say is humble beginnings to Newfoundland in 1919? What's his route?
He did what all of these people did. He worked really, really hard. He worked and worked and worked to find opportunities, to move himself forwards, to give himself an escape from the predestined path for somebody who might of the life that he might expect to live with that upbringing. He moved to England. He ended up at Brooklyn's Flying Village as well and met Jack Alcock there. He got a job with Tom Sopwith, who became a very famous aviator, not much older than Hawker at the time. And flying lessons came with the job. He learned to fly, and he was clearly a natural, as Jack Alcock was. They became very close friends. Their paths parted during the war. Alcock flew for what became the Royal Air Force, where Harry Hawker became a test pilot and a rather fearless test pilot. By the time 1919 came along, Harry Hawker was probably the most famous pilot in Britain, probably one of the most well-paid pilots in the world. But he had a bug. He couldn't get it out of his head. He had to fly the Atlantic. So he teamed up with Sopwith to send an aeroplane over to Newfoundland to be first across.
A detail about Harry. He's fearless in a way that seems superhuman. Did he strike you that way, David?
Absolutely. He's a really interesting and complex character. He could be quite spiky. He could be impatient. He could be difficult to be with, moody, perhaps, when he was struggling with a problem. But he was fearless, but not in a careless way. It was always calculated fearlessness. He understood the risks of every maneuver that he took. He knew that it was a risky business, but he would take the risks having calculated them almost instinctively and almost immediately, where few other pilots could. He understood the aeroplanes he was flying intimately, and he performed tricks and stunts and tests that that most people couldn't even imagine carrying out.
His wife Muriel, he married her in 1917-19 during the war, and he hid his wounds. She knew about them. Bad back, all kinds of things went wrong in his crashes, and we would say he played through the pain. Did he talk about that afterwards? I know he didn't live long, but did he ever speak of how he did that?
As far as I know, he only talked about it with Muriel and with a tiny handful of friends that he got to know, particularly during the war, Australian friends, actually, who flew in Britain as well. He had a spinal injury, a spinal disease, as well as other health problems, and he told nobody. He knew, I think, that his flying days were always numbered from about halfway through the war. And he pushed on through them. He didn't tell anybody, because why would he? That would mean that he would have to admit it to himself.
Another team led by Fred Rainman, born in the 1890s, I believe, a young man at this point. How was his war?
Fred Rainman was a Suffolk farmer's boy who was quiet, but he had a steely resolve. His war looked set to be pretty good. He was test flying for the British manufacturers, as Harry Hawker was. Halfway through the war, he had a very, very bad accident where the rear end of the plane, the tail assembly, snapped off in mid-flight, and he fell to the Brooklands track. It was a miracle he landed on grass and not on the concrete track or any of the buildings. I think that left him undaunted, if a little shaken. He was quieter than the other boys from Brooklands who ended up at Newfoundland in 1919, but he had just as much determination, perhaps more so, actually, although he hid it rather well.
He took up with an airplane and motorcycle builder named Martinside. None of these things are there, but this is early days. Was there profit in building aircraft then?
Well, before the war and during the war, there was great profits. During the war, there was almost limitless profits in making aeroplanes. But as Tom Sopwith was later to say, as soon as the armistice was signed, literally overnight, the market for aeroplanes ended. The order books, they all had full order books for aeroplanes for the armed forces. Well, those emptied. Any aeroplanes they had in stock that hadn't yet been delivered ended up being sold effectively for scrap value. So overnight, there was no market for aeroplanes. Commercial aviation, civil aviation had to be invented. So the companies tended to pivot to motorcycles, motor cars. Sopwith ended up making kitchenware, made aluminium saucepans to try and tide themselves over. So Northcliffe's prize in 1919 was a potential industry saver, because it would help turn the public on to aviation as civil aviation, commercial aviation, as something for them rather than as a military weapon.
The fourth team, Englishmen, Handley Page Group, and led by an admiral, Mark Kerr. What do we need to know about him? We have about a minute, David.
The Handley Page Company put forward a huge four-engine biplane bomber with a four-person crew. Admiral Kerr was about as different from Fred and Harry and Jack as you could get. He was born in a palace. He was born to a very illustrious naval family, and he acted very differently during the competition in 1919 in Newfoundland. He was very far apart from those other boys, and they knew it, unfortunately.
Yes, the class distinction comes through. That's the first time in your book. When I saw Mark Kerr enter the scene, I thought, well, this is going to go some way, the direction I think the rest of it's going. Otherwise, what I take generalized before we get to Newfoundland is that these are strivers, the young men. They not only want to make something of themselves, they have a vision, a dream, they share it. And that explains a deal of their camaraderie, despite the fact this is a race for £10,000. David Rooney, the Big Hop, the first nonstop flight across the Atlantic Ocean and into the future. Next spring, Newfoundland. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.